Thank you, Peter. I've never had the honor before of following Gandhi. It sets a kind of precipice in terms of where I need to venture now. It's a double bind, insofar as I'm announced as the lunchtime speaker, and there is no lunch. No free lunch, no. But it's coming in the next one. But I had thought about the challenge of trying to present while you're eating, and at least I've avoided that, even though I don't have the... at least I have the sense in which there's hunger among you. I want to thank Peter Kaufman for inviting me to this. I want to give you a little bit of a background in terms of where I'm coming from. I'm actually on the panel twice to talk about publishing in a later session, but at this point I want to talk about the economics of knowledge as a public good. And one of Richard's remarks that we shouldn't even be talking about the economics is kind of troubling to me. But I immediately thought of the famous free chalk movement that did so poorly as an effort to bring educational materials to everyone. You don't remember the free chalk movement. It was one of those same kinds of spirited things in which the economics weren't important, but the principle, the educational principle, was at the forefront. And that I think there are practical questions that we do need to address. And I think Anne set the stage this morning in thinking about and mentioning the word funding. And I want to come, not out of disrespect for Gandhi, I want to come at this in terms of a different approach, partly out of my own background. I am a professor of education. I work at the University of British Columbia, and I have a day job, which is the preparation of English teachers for the schools in Vancouver. Where it doesn't turn white like this at all. It just rains continuously through this whole season. And one of the things I just learned this morning, or failed to appreciate before, is it's not just that it rains, it's that rain isn't bright like snow. And that it really brightens up things to have the snow around, whereas our rain keeps it kind of dark and dull without the sun. Yes. There are other advantages. I get to bike to work and things like that. But I want to consider the economics of knowledge as a public good, in a number of different ways, but the principal idea, I think, is value. Now, almost everything I have in my notes has been mentioned by the previous speakers, by Paul, Eric, James, and Mark, and so I want to provide a series of footnotes. There is a danger of speaking to the converted, but this is speaking to the rehearsed, and so I want to be able to illustrate some of the points that have been made earlier in terms of creating a sense in which we are part of a common spirit, but that we need to get our story straight. Because I work with English teachers, and because we work in the field of literature, and because we are convinced that the power of language moves the world, and more importantly, that the power of stories, that the power of a well-told tale is critical for changing the world. And so in some way, the fact that we are telling the same stories, and this is a poor apology, I realize that, but in some ways, that we're telling the same stories is a good thing. Not only because we need to hear them over and over again, but it's the variations, it's the details, it's what sticks with us. Because we have a job as the converted, as the rehearsed, to convince others. And that's where the real challenge lies. And so if I can give you something that will enable you to convince one or two or three or four other people, and perhaps use this in a way that will convince one or two or 300 other people, then that's the way things are going to change in terms of the economics of open content and open knowledge. Now, the critical idea for me in terms of the economics, and I told you that I was an English teacher because there was a reference earlier to the sense of expertise. I mean, who are you going to trust? We've had two economists at least, maybe three. We've got clearly someone who knows the legal system inside and out, and we have a school teacher, and someone who's worked with children, and someone who believes very strongly in public education, and we all know how well economically run that is. So out of that basis of strong economics, I want to suggest that value is the key concept. That the economics of knowledge as a public good is based on the idea that we need to increase and make clear the value, and the funding will follow, rather than the other way around. That is to have the funding in place first, and to have the business model and the business plan first, and then to move forward in terms of knowledge as a public good. If we can demonstrate and continue to demonstrate not only the value, but the ability to increase that value, a theme that has come up repeatedly this morning, to increase that value along two dimensions that I want to address this morning, and that is the public dimension and the scholarly dimension. When I'm talking about knowledge as a public good, I want to focus instrumentally, if you like, or opportunistically, on one element, and that is scholarly knowledge. Not just broadly educational knowledge, but that particular body of work that's locked up, as it were, in many cases, in the journal literature. It seems to me an opportune time to consider, as it were, the public value of scholarly literature, and in particular, the journal literature. Now, I just spoke to Alan Farren, the head of MIT, the director of MIT Press, about getting my book online as a free copy, as Eric's book is now, too. But the book business has not been about open access in the same way that the journal literature is. So let me talk to you then about the ways in which we can increase the value, and ways in which the value has been increasing, in terms of access to knowledge, in terms of knowledge as a public good. And let me introduce one technical term at the beginning, and give you some sense of how that works, and that's the term open access. Richard Stallman made it clear that he was not in favor of the concept of open. He wanted the term free, and it's an interesting debate, and Stephen Weber's book talks a bit about how that debate emerged. I like the idea that principles start at the number zero and move up. That's one I want to hold on to and think more about. But I want to suggest that the open access movement is a particular form. It was not my vote either. I voted for free to read as the best title, coming out of the literature background. I thought it kind of rolled off the tongue better. It had a little assonance to it. But open access was the one that was decided. It's stuck, and it continues to grow. Open access refers, in a technical sense, to the ability to access the journal literature freely online. You can download it, you can print it, you cannot sample it in a way that loses the sense of attribution. But open access refers to that free access to the published and peer-reviewed literature. That comes in two forms that we need to keep in mind. And even putting them in order is somewhat controversial from within this field of the open access movement. But let me start with the journal. There are open access journals today. In fact, the University of Lund lists 2,000 open access journals in terms of being published immediately, freely available online. Now, they are not free in the sense that Richard began to suggest there, because you still need a computer, you still need an internet connection. But they are free in terms of the public libraries, they are free in terms of the high schools, they are free certainly in terms of institutions like this. So 2,000 journals, I'm sure the number is more. There's a kind of middle literature, like the New England Journal of Medicine, which is available freely after 6 months. Purists in the open access movement would say no, of course, 6 months is too long. And I suppose if you have one of the illnesses being covered in the magazine that week, it would seem too long to wait 6 months to see the information for free. But more importantly to me is the information is available. Highwire Press at University of Stanford Library, has over 1 million articles free, most of them some months after they have been published from the 800 or 900 journals which Highwire Press publishes. So we have a growing sense then of obligation in the literature. New England Journal of Medicine, as you know, is a very successful financial operation, a nonprofit, but still very successful. But it has felt the moral persuasion to make its materials free, as I say, after 6 months. The British Medical Journal has been making its materials for free for years and has recently had to close some of that access off because its advertising model was not working. But we're hoping that Google has been changing that and will continue to change it in a way that the British Medical Journal will return to its free basis. So that's movement, that's the one step to open access. The second step, because it's only still a limited sample of journals. Not all of us find the New England Journal of Medicine an appropriate outlet. The 2,000 journals listed at the University of Lund don't work for all of us. What about the rest of the literature? Well, it's interesting here, because the publishers have been persuaded, have been moved by this open access approach. The figures are now not over 90% of the publishers of journals, 93% I think was the last figure I saw, sample of 9,000 journals, have now permitted their authors to what's called self-archive published work. They can take the final copy, not the PDF at Elsevier or Springer, or Kluver or Taylor and Francis published, but the final author's version after it's been peer-reviewed, and they can self-archive it now at an institutional repository on their own website and create open access to 90% of the commercially locked up copyright given away literature. So this is a tremendous boon. This is virtually the entire body of literature. Now, what's interesting here about this, and again, there are questions about the best copy because it's not the absolute final copy, because it doesn't have all of the wonderful copy editing corrections that Elsevier has introduced. I know with my interviews with editors, I see a smile in the audience here. I don't know if you've worked with Elsevier, but the people I've interviewed have said that the copy editing adds considerably to the amount of time they have to spend doing corrections when they resubmit it, and that, in fact, the value add there is somewhat dubious. But the bigger problem is if Elsevier has been convinced that open access is a critical enough issue that they have changed their copyright policy. They still retain the copyright, but they permit the institutional repositories. If the institutional repositories are now in the numbers of about 600 around the world, MIT is responsible for the DSpace, the open source DSpace software, which actually I'm surprised wasn't on this program. But the DSpace software is being used by hundreds of institutions to create these repositories. How come the literature isn't there? How come 90% of the journal literature isn't available? And the question there for me is largely around faculty indifference, faculty ignorance, that we have yet to persuade faculty of the value, the public value of this knowledge. And so part of my concern is that we address the sense of public expectation and the sense of scholarly expectation in terms of improving the case for knowledge as a public good. Now, the direction I want to head with this in terms of the economics of it is a mixed economy. The categoricalness with which Richard spoke in a kind of revealed truth manner for me is flawed in terms of its ability to persuade people. What has been demonstrated over the last 10 years is that we have an incredibly mixed economy and that what we need to do is see that economy across a single principle of improved access. That is, the question here is not what is the best financial model. The question here is not what is true open access. The question here is, what is increasing access? What is providing access to more people in more ways to use, contribute to, build on that knowledge? And the economics of that access appears to be strongly a mixed economy. So that we do have, as it were, the nonprofit societies contributing. We have the foundations. We have commercial enterprises like Elsevier in its way, Kluver and Springer, rather, and Taylor and Francis and others. We have service industries now that, in terms of Google and Google Scholar, that are providing on a commercial basis, a kind of Red Hat model, in terms of providing service for the scholarly community in return for what is essentially an increase in access. So the idea that this mixed economy is the way forward and that each of us is engaged in a series of experiments around this economy, the champion of which we cannot predict, but most likely there will not be a single champion. And our support for this mixed economy is focused very much on demonstrating and increasing the expectation of access to this model, of this knowledge, and increasing the sense of its value. Now, let me do this in two ways. I'm going to speak later in the session about my software that I've developed as part of the Public Knowledge Project. And one of the things we learned in the development of the software for journal publishing to reduce costs is that if you pretend to change only one thing, you do a much better job with people. Even though, and we had a kind of reference to this earlier, even my best lines have been taken earlier, if you think back, this idea that we are not about changing every aspect. I think it was Paul's remarks that mentioned that. That's right. You were changing the library, you were changing the publishing world, but not only changing small things. I think it was the reference. My sense is that you focus on changing one thing, and that is the increase of access. And other changes will follow. It's going to change the library, by all means. It's going to change the way people learn. In institutions like the University of Michigan and outside of institutions thanks to Wikipedia and what I hope will be greater access to academic knowledge. So this idea of beginning to change one aspect suggests that there's a historical continuity that we're missing. That is, the focus today on the economics of open content tends to treat things ahistorically, tends to say this is something brand new, this is a new phenomenon, how are we going to get on top of it? Stephen Weber, in his book on open source, asked the question, where is it going to hit next? Where is open source going to hit next? As if this was born whole out of Richard's head, and that we now have to think about where it's going to be applied. I think the better approach, the more informed approach, and for me, the stronger narrative approach is the historical continuity. And let me just give you one example of that, and that's going back to James's remark about the library movement. We forget about the library movement. The library movement did start, and I appreciate Eric's setting us up in terms of users, came out of a users movement, largely known as miners. Miners have been in the news recently in tragic situations, but miners have also been at the founding of public libraries. It's an odd concept, but the miners' libraries in Wales and through the UK in the beginning of the 19th century was really the start, the pooling of a few shillings to begin to purchase books, to begin to build, as it were, part of a union movement, access to reading materials among a group that was just basically literate, was the beginning of a library movement. But it was also technically inspired. The interesting development through the 19th century from these miners' libraries, from the mechanics institutes, from the mutual improvement societies, which is a concept I think we should ought to get onto a URL pretty quickly. The mutual improvement societies of the early 19th century, very much based on a sharing of resources and a sharing of knowledge. The mutual improvement societies, my favorite, the Shakespeare Mutual Improvement Society, Shakespeare being this great common man kind of figure, would gather together in coffee houses and ale houses and pubs. Were part of the attraction still today. The Starbucks model is to have a newspaper or two available freely and to begin to gather and share that knowledge at that point. So this idea then of a public library movement begins in the 19th century with users. It takes off, though, with the penny press. It takes off with a reduction in the cost of printing. It takes off with the introduction in the late part of the century with the steam press. That as printing costs dropped and the availability, the cost of books dropped, the possibility of a public library movement arose. And so the institutional organization of public libraries was a combination of a working class movement and technological developments. And the idea that today that the open content or the open knowledge, the open access movement, is based on a similar convergence of public interest and new technologies is part of the historical continuity that we need to realize, and that we are not introducing, as it were, an upsetting revolution that is causing major content holders to panic, as someone mentioned earlier in the questions, but that we are part of a continuous historical movement is a critical aspect for me. What's interesting from my side, from the academic side, is how scholarly these libraries turned out to be. The Rochdale Cooperative in Manchester, in England, subscribed to 33 monthlies and 9 quarterlies, including, for example, the Agricultural Economist, that there was an interest in this scholarly knowledge and that these cooperatives and semi-union organizations were very much involved in its take-up. Now, what came out of this, the struggle that came out of this, was not a resistance to the access itself. It was the notion of bringing periodicals into the libraries. So at the end of that century, the 19th century, in the 1880s, 1890s, among the library movement, the public library movement, one of the big questions was the danger of bringing in periodicals. The danger, apparently, was it attracted what was called the malodorous classes. I didn't recognize this term at first, the malodorous classes, and that it was a threat to the public library's whole standing. And part of the debate, the most interesting aspect for me, was the architectural one. And that is, if you were going to introduce and attract the malodorous classes by bringing in periodicals, because clearly the middle classes had these coming into their homes, where were you going to put this room? And so part of the debate would be, and they didn't have PowerPoint, but they had murals posters and architectural drawings that it was appropriate close to the door. That the best advice they had was to use it as a bait and switch. That they would come in and be attracted to the periodicals and sit down and have a look at them. After a while, they would feel the redeeming power of literacy and perhaps change of clothing and would enter the library whole and the main part. And so it was an interesting kind of tension between the need of the public library to reach a wider public and the danger that it would somehow upset the atmosphere and tone as well as the, if you wish, the climate of the libraries. So this idea that there is a kind of misperception, what seems humorous to us around the dangers of this access to knowledge, is probably something that we're living through in its own form in terms of access to the research that I'm talking about. So let me move. That's one historical example. There are many. So we have a sense of the historical continuity. We still need to talk about that public value. And I think the greatest demonstration of that has been with the health literature. That is the public value of access to basic research. Now, I am a literacy educator. I'm a literature and literacy educator. So I know that the public cannot read medical research. I have every confidence that the medical research is so many grade levels above the average public reading level, that there is no danger that the public will be reading the research. And I would have said that 10 years ago with complete confidence, knowing that it's my one area of expertise which I could stand up here and pronounce on. And then I would have to say to you now, 10 years later, that I am dead wrong on every aspect of that. That the public's uptake of medical health research has caused what the Pew Foundation has called a health revolution. That there are now, the statistics are around 80% of the patients that go into doctor's offices are bringing with them, either in printouts or in their heads, a sense of some information that they have found online. That 93 million Americans have gone online for health reasons, and that 7 million go on every day to find out information on health. Not all of it good. In fact, most of the information that they can find online is very dubious, because we keep 90% of that information that the universities produce locked up. But what's interesting in terms of the medical profession's take on this is that it is changing the state of the relationship with patients. Now, it's true, the first physician I spoke to about this referred to it as this is a medical term, a time suck. And that, in fact, in her 15-minute scheduled appointment with the patient, she would have to spend 10 to 14 minutes explaining that the medical information that the patient had brought into the office was, in fact, not the symptoms exactly that she had, and that there were different complications, and that at the end of that, she had to reschedule in the last minute another appointment. When I heard this story, and this was a source of complaint for her, for the physician, when I heard the story, I said to myself inside, terrific, that was a great 15 minutes. It was an educational moment. But it also changed the dynamics. Now, the medical profession has picked this up a bit. That is, when I first introduced this 4 or 5 years ago, I thought the name for it would be patient intimidation, that it would be the new wave of kind of a democratization of the physician's office. They now call it a shared decision making. The physicians, the AMA is, smart group. They decided patient intimidation was not a good name for this movement. And they now call it shared decision-making. I call it a democratic moment, an educational moment, that has changed the tyranny of expertise in some of our lives. I don't know about you in physicians' offices. One of the studies that was done in Glasgow of physicians, the 60% of the doctors who were faced with this information frankly admitted that they were informed by it, that they hadn't known about the information, that it didn't necessarily apply to the patients who brought it in, but that it applied to their practice. I thought immediately that this should be tax deductible for the patients who print out this material, that it was part of the continuing medical education of the physicians that they were serving, that it should now become a tax deduction for the toner or whatever it is it takes to bring in these materials. But the idea that this access to information is not only changing, as it were, the knowledge of this, the value of this knowledge, but it's changing the democratic quality of our daily lives is a critical aspect in terms of what we might talk about as a public good. Now, there are other examples of this, but this is probably one of the strongest in terms of the health field. I'm hoping that it will follow in the field of education, in law, and social services, where we can see a similar kind of expectation. But where is the medical literature? Let me remind you that PubMed is one of the great services, and I didn't mention the role of the government in providing this service, and perhaps it's not appropriate in this country to do that. But the government plays a critical role with the PubMed. And if you don't know PubMed, you should. PubMed has been designed to provide access to medical research for researchers. What has happened, it has been transformed by patient uptake, and it now has a whole channel called Medline Plus that's designed for lay people. And even the lay people's area, where it talks in simple terms about diagnosis and about the diseases and the patterns of the symptoms, always provides a link to PubMed, where the primary and basic research is. And the idea that we can have that expectation that we have a right to know. When you go into PubMed, though, run by the National Library of Medicine at well over $110 or so million dollars a year, when you go into PubMed, what it turns out to be is half access and half catalog or sales pitch for materials. So you're taking a chance. You put in the symptoms or the keywords. You come up with a series of articles, and about 15 to 20% of them will have a little red green line on them, which means you can have access to them. About 80% of them will take you through to Elsevier and other publishers, where the cost will be $44 for 24 hours access to the article. Of course, you can print it out and get a longer access. But the idea that we have access only to 20% of the literature, and that we are cut off from 80% of the literature, is a major concern, and that 80% access could be provided by most of the authors, because most of the authors are publishing in journals where they have permission. And this becomes part of a critical aspect. Let me just consider this indifference, this troubling aspect of faculty conviction. That is, the economic model, and I'll speak about the economic model in a moment, but the key element is we need to establish the public value of this knowledge, and we need to establish the scholarly value. Now, the arguments this morning that have been presented, you would think would be sufficient to convince the entire academic body. And that is principally the ethical argument, the moral argument. You've heard that term four or five times this morning. It's an obvious one. There's a moral compulsion, I would say, if you have produced knowledge at public expense, to share that knowledge. It hasn't worked. It hasn't convinced people. We need further arguments. And I want to share some of those with you. By the way, you could also quote, as part of that ethical argument, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which makes a nice distinction, thank you, Eleanor Roosevelt, which makes a nice distinction between having, as it were, being able to share the fruits of science, which I take to be Bayer aspirin, the fruits of science, but also having access to the knowledge itself. So it's not enough that every human being has the right, as it were, to benefit from science, that they should have the right to benefit from that knowledge, from access to the knowledge itself. Let me give you some of the other arguments we need to do. Let me start with the highest level argument, work right down to the vanity argument. I think the vanity is the cincher, okay? But I want to save that one for a bit of drama. But let me start with the epistemological argument, and let me continue with James' notion of Newton, Isaac Newton. The epistemological argument, which you're all familiar with, but let's just remind ourselves, and was introduced this morning, and that is, if knowledge does not circulate widely, freely, openly, then its claim to being knowledge has been undermined. So the fact that universities across the developing world do not have access to our current body of knowledge, and yet we feel entirely confident in that knowledge, suggests a grave problem to me. That it is not being exposed to the entire academic community at this point undermines its very claim to knowledge. Now, there's a risk to that greater access, and I want to go back to Isaac Newton that James introduced to you earlier. And that is the whole Oldenburg, in fact, James did mention that I might use this anecdote, that Oldenburg starts the Philosophical Transactions, as James mentioned, in 1665, and Oldenburg is an entrepreneur. I mean, he gets no support, very little support from the Royal Society, and certainly not for publishing. He intended to make £50 a year on the Philosophical Transactions when he launched them, and complained bitterly about publishing costs, the printer's costs, and all those sorts of things you might be very familiar with, those of you in the publishing industry. But at any rate, it was an enterprise on his part, and he was enterprising about it and did approach Newton. Now, Newton, as you may know, is a fairly secretive fellow. Open was not Newton's middle name. He resisted that. We have letters he sent to Boyle in which they promised never to share what they knew, and we're still not sure what that was about. So secretiveness was Newton's manner. So how is it that he published in the first 5 years or 6 years of this journal? Well, he was struck by this phenomenon. Here he is, a brand new professor, still in his 20s, an endowed named chair, still in his 20s, and this new thing is published, 16-page pamphlet called Philosophical Transactions, and we have his notes. He took extensive notes from the Philosophical Transactions for 4 or 5 years, and finally he was approached by Oldenburg, and he said he would publish, a letter in those days. Very famous opening line of his article is, "Sir." The opening of a letter. Now, what's also interesting about this is the only article he ever published. Now, I pause on that moment. It's an important one for me. I don't know about you, but I've got Newton so beat. One article in his whole life. That's true. He had very good tenure. But what's interesting about it in terms of Newton's personality is he lives to regret it. He knew that something important was going on, that knowledge had a new kind of openness to it with the Philosophical Transactions, a 16-page pamphlet that was available in printer's shops, and that this was a very different... The books... Remember, this is 200 years after the printing press has been invented, after Copernicus and others had used the printing press to cause revolutions. This was a new form that was widely available at a whole new cost level, price point. What happens immediately after he publishes? He's inundated by letters, by questions, by challenges, by critiques. His response is, "This is tedious." His opening line for each of the letters, "As I have already explained in my original article," but it wasn't true. Each time he was challenged for the 4 years till he cut it off, till he told Henry Oldenburg, "I want no more letters. I will not respond to this any further," till he put away his optics work. As James mentioned, that was the focus of it. It's the old blind with the slit in it and the prism. But for those 4 years, he continued to elucidate aspects of the experiment itself and set a standard for openness in terms of being able to replicate the experiments. And even though he would not publish his book on optics till one of his leading critics was dead, although he had a kind of mystical sense to him, I bet Newton was still afraid there would be questions coming from the other side. But there was, in that demonstration, in that early years of publishing, a sense of experimentation around openness, a risk, a danger, a sense of uncomfortable challenge, but an embrace of it. And I call that an epistemological principle that we need to reconsider, because the level of openness in the current literature is insufficient in a way that undermines our very claims to knowledge. The economic, let me deal with three other areas: the economic, the legal, and the vanity. The economic question, and that is the publishing cost question. That is, we have real costs to publish. We have, someone said we needed to sustain 100 university publishers. My approach has been that we cannot continue to guarantee the revenue for journals. And that, in fact, if you speak to journal publishers, and we have some here, the number of subscriptions is declining, is continuing to decline. The number of personal subscriptions is continuing to decline and started to decline before open access came onto the scene. And so what we have is a proliferation in the number of titles, but we have a decreasing circulation in the journals. So what we have is a restricted access to the body of knowledge. And this applies perhaps not to every university library within 5 miles of where I'm standing, but outside of that radius, it applies around the world, and in particular to developing countries. So we have this weird situation in an age of a knowledge-based economy that we have declining access. And the economic model has to be, in terms of public goods, not the guarantee of revenue for scholarly societies, not the guarantee of revenue for university presses, but a reduction in costs. And we need to look at economic models where we can reduce that cost. And part of the work that we've been doing at the Public Knowledge Project at the University of British Columbia has been developing those kinds of models. And what we've done is we've developed an open source, if you like, open source solution to journal management and journal publishing. And it came out of the challenge that came up repeatedly is, how can we put journals online? It will just increase our costs. And when we tried to find out how much it cost to put journals online, we got a lovely distribution. Gene Glass, Arizona State, publishes a journal called the Educational Policy Analysis Archives, probably the worst titled journal, I might not even have it right now, in Christendom, published it for free, told us he had zero costs. We went from zero costs to Cornell University that said it spent $600,000 involved in its Project Euclid and other elements in terms of the cost of its publishing. So as a social scientist, I was kind of disturbed by this. I had bad data. I had a distribution from zero to 600,000. I don't have to tell you, there's a variance problem there, lack of reliability. We had a kind of averaging at 20,000, but nothing really that we could feel confident about. So we went into the business, as it were, of trying to develop the software. And we spent, up to this point, we've spent about $200,000 developing this software for journal management and journal publishing, and I'll tell you more about it later. But the key is, we made it open source. And so the next person doesn't have to spend $200,000. And that there's now a way, and there are many ways, we're one of a number of systems, open source systems and solutions in this area. So the economic question is not a simple one. I don't want to suggest that. But the economic one is within reach in terms of increasing access. And again, we need the experimentation of open source. We need the experimentation of different systems. We need the users kind of intervention that Eric suggested earlier in terms of that development. But let me go to the legal and the vanity questions. Let me get to the punchline. The legal and vanity are very closely connected. I don't know if you've noticed that about the law, but I say that with all due respect. The legal question is copyright. And the copyright, and even though Creative Commons has been a tremendous contribution in terms of our understanding of copyright. The idea that copyright was compulsory, that the author had no choice, is something that had never occurred to me. That it was a kind of natural right, but it was also something you couldn't easily revoke. And the Creative Commons has provided us a way around that. But the truth is, copyright is in favor of open access in terms of scholarship. Copyright is sufficient and adequate because copyright protects the interests of only two parties. The creator, out of deference to George Bush, the author, let's say, in a more secular sense, the author and the public. Now, the idea that copyright protects the public is the limitation on copyright. In perpetuity was a proposal that has come from publishers since the very introduction of copyright in Queen Anne in 1710. And perpetuity has been revoked, or has been refuted and denied, I thank heaven, over all those three centuries in terms of copyright. So there is a protection of the public that ultimately, even though thanks to Mickey Mouse it's about 90 years for Disney and 70 years for authors in the United States, but there is a protection of the public. But it's the author's protection I want to consider. The author's protection in terms of open access. Now, again, as mentioned earlier, the economy here, the economics of knowledge as a public good for faculty members and researchers is based on reputation. It's a reputation economy. If you're not read, if you're not cited, then you won't get to take the podium. And so this idea then that what's really in the interest of the author in terms of scholarship is circulation. And we have begun to study the impact of open access on the circulation of knowledge. And so if it is in the author's best interests, in terms of getting the best view from their office windows, or the best job offers, or the best or increases in their merit pay, its reputation. And what happens when you make your work open access? It's a given. Circulation of it goes up. The citation level goes up. How much does it go up? Well, it differs by field. If you're in physics, the figures right now are 250% increase in citations. You can improve your reputation by 250%. Think of the pride that your mother would have if you could report a 250% increase in your citations over the last 12 months because you started to make your work freely available. Even though you published in physical letters A or B, you still took the time to self-archive your work in the library, and you noticed, now I can't guarantee these results, I am a social scientist, but some people have experienced, on average, 250% increase. If you're in philosophy, I can't offer you more than 50% increase. There's just not a lot of citation going on in philosophy, and it's a much lower uptake. But the idea that open access is increasing the circulation has been demonstrated. And you know that if it's a citation level increase of 250%, then the readership level is how many more times that? How much more often? The journal that Gene Glass runs for Zero, Educational Policy Analysis Archives, has 1,200 people come in every day, unique visitors. Now, I don't have to tell you, an educational journal on policy doesn't normally have that kind of traffic. If it sells 600 subscriptions worldwide, it would be thrilled. 75 countries come in to Gene Glass's. He's done a survey, 1% of the people that come in are journalists. 6% are parents, 12% are practicing teachers into this journal because it's freely, openly, entirely available online. It changes the relationship and status and presence of knowledge in this society. And the key element of open access is that it is going to change that presence and that value. And out of a change in the value, the funding will follow. Now, there are still questions I want to address about how we share this knowledge, but let me draw to a close at this point. The idea then is that public access to knowledge is available in terms of economic reasons, in terms of ethical compulsion, in terms of the sensibility around the whole legal situation. The possibility is that it will change the nature of our work, and even if it changes only this one thing, and that is the degree or quality of access, my argument is that it will improve the scholarly quality as well. Because insofar as this knowledge more widely circulates, its quality is bound to increase. Thank you very much.
A couple of questions and then we'll do lunch in the hall. Hi, I'm David Pierce. I'm on the editorial board for a journal for Moving Image Archiving, which I refuse to get my articles in because they take your copyright. And the editor of the journal insisted that it had to be a printed journal. He refused to do it as online. Can you address that?
Yes.